Well, clearly, this is a big, big news day here on Political Rewind. Tremors going through Washington, D.C., as the first two indictments and the first guilty plea in Robert Mueller's investigation of Russian collusion. We are going to talk about all that. Jim Galloway, my sidekick, the lead political writer for the AJC, is with me in the studio. Jim, welcome.
Thank you. I want it to be known that I am only a volunteer with this operation. I receive no pay.
Galloway's already heard Sarah Huckabee Sanders. You're going to hear her in a minute talk about just that. And joining us from what I consider one of two great cities on Lake Michigan, my hometown, Chicago, the other being Milwaukee, the conservative radio personality, Charlie Sykes. Hi, Charlie. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you today.
I feel very fortunate that we, by luck, invited you a while back to come on to talk about your book, How the Right Lost Its Mind, and now also get a chance to talk with you about the remarkable stories that are breaking in Washington. Let's just take a minute,
sure.
Because the White House briefing got underway about 40 minutes ago. We know that President Trump's already been tweeting about the indictments. And Sarah Huckabee Sanders came to the podium and had very similar messages. Let's just listen to what she said, and then we'll talk to Charlie and Jim.
But look, today's announcement has nothing to do with the president, has nothing to do with the president's campaign or campaign activity. The real collusion scandal, as we've said several times before, has everything to do with the Clinton campaign, Fusion GPS, and Russia. There's clear evidence of the Clinton campaign colluding with Russian intelligence to spread disinformation and smear the president to influence the election. We've been saying from day one there's been no evidence of Trump-Russia collusion, and nothing in the indictment today changes that at all.
Papadopoulos' agreement is about the campaign. It is specifically about the campaign.
It has nothing to do with the activities of the campaign. It has to do with his failure to tell the truth. That doesn't have anything to do with the campaign or the campaign's activities.
But it is the clearest evidence yet of ties between the Trump campaign and Russian officials. So.
Again, there are no activities or official capacity in which the Trump campaign was engaged in any of these activities. Most of them took place well before the campaign ever even existed. John.
Sarah, can you just explain what George Papadopoulos' role with the campaign was?
It was extremely limited. It was a volunteer position. And again, no activity was ever done in an official capacity on behalf of the campaign in that regard.
All right, that's in the White House briefing room within the last 40 minutes. Charlie Sykes, let me just get your general reaction to the stories that are breaking today and what you heard Sarah Huckabee Sanders say.
Well, what a tangled web they appear to be continuing to weave here. Obviously, this is a very, very dramatic development, particularly because it comes after a week of what certainly looked like to me as a coordinated attack on this investigation, almost prepping the battlefield to discredit the Mueller investigation, possibly setting up the firing of the special prosecutor. And in all of the investment on two things, that there's nothing there, there's no collusion, number one. And number two, you know, what about the whataboutism, the deflection, the distraction? It's all about Hillary Clinton. But that becomes much more difficult today when you really do see these indictments. Yes, the Manafort-Gates indictment does not involve the campaign, but the Papadopoulos indictment and guilty plea, that points directly at collusion. He's a cooperating witness. He's pled guilty. That has got to have the White House sweating.
Yeah, Jim, I think what Charlie said is really important for a couple of reasons. Number one, you heard Sarah Huckabee Sanders say this all happened a long time before the campaign. That's what Papadopoulos tried to tell the feds, and it was pointed out to him that he joined the campaign just a couple of days after a contact with this Russian agent who may very
right.
well
have been working with the government. Yeah, I think he was named a foreign policy advisor 1st of March and then mid-March is when he started meeting with someone called the professor.
Yeah.
And you know, I've got to say, when somebody like Ms. Sanders tells a story like that, the first thing a reporter is going to do is going to be to try to check the expense reports to find out where the money was going and how much money was flowing to Mr. Papadopoulos.
Charlie, rather than try to dissect all of the news at this point, let me turn it to a conversation about what you expect the repercussions of this are likely to be. So let me throw out a few things here, if I may. Number one, the president would like to see the tax plan rolled out on Wednesday, and then he leaves for his Asian trip on Thursday. It seems like both of those things are going to be under a cloud. But beyond that, what you have been writing, one of the points you make in your book is that Republican leaders, many on Capitol Hill, are essentially victims of Stockholm syndrome. They're held in the sway of the president and can't free themselves from it. Is this the beginning of a crack in that you believe could, in fact, turn people against the president?
Well, not yet.
Well, We haven't seen that.
Well, you know, I do think this is one of those questions that Republicans are going to have to ask. I mean, it's one thing for Republicans to support the president on some of the domestic issues they agree with him on, you know, the judiciary, tax cuts. It's something else for them to carry water for him when you see this unraveling Russia scandal. And remember, this is just day one of the Mueller indictment. There's a lot more to come here. This is a rolling investigation. So how deeply invested do they want to be in providing air cover for Donald Trump? You know, are they going to keep going to the mat for him? Is it going to continue to be this Stockholm syndrome where we just cannot criticize the president? I mean, if I'm on Capitol Hill, I at least want to know where the exit doors are. I may not be headed there yet, but I want to know where you know when am I going to have to pull that chute?
Yeah. Well, first of all, Charlie, I need to tell everybody out there that this is a very well written book.
Thank you.
I got to say, when the phrase radio talk show hits my ears,
Jim.
But this is. This is a highly literate, well argued work that I would recommend very much to anybody here. But you know what happened today. This reminds me of 2006 and Jack Abramoff. You know, everybody saw what Jack Abramoff was doing. The Washington Post wrote stellar articles about this is how the money flows. And then suddenly the scales fall from our eyes and they say, oh yeah, this is indictable. That's what's happened with Paul Manafort, it looks like to me.
Charlie?
Yeah, the amount of the sleaze here, and you do wonder, because it does create this sort of miasma over this administration. And you know, I know they're trying to say, well, this all happened before the campaign. Well, this was also relatively, some of it was well known or should have been known when Donald Trump chose him to be the chairman of his campaign. And there's always been that cognitive dissonance between this, you know, populist campaign and then the people that the president has surrounded himself with, you know, the whole draining the swamp. Hmm. And we're going to get a picture of some of the new swamp creatures that in fact have been brought into American politics by Donald Trump.
Yeah. And, you know, it strikes me that when the president, as he did late this morning, middle of the morning, tweets out once again, no collusion in all caps. We get it. We understand that that's the message he wants to send out there. But in fact, Charlie, isn't it fair to say that what's happening to Manafort and his number one assistant, Rick Gates, it may not be directly related to the campaign, but it certainly opens a door for further action against both of those men. And there may very well be more there that Mueller is digging into. So the president jumps in there. He knows what his message is, but he's celebrating. He's spiking the football a little early, isn't he?
Oh, way too early. And in fact, well, I mean, this is day one. This is just the first indictments, and we're starting to find out that Mueller obviously knows a lot more than a lot of other people had known or reported up until then. So, yes, there could be more coming out about Manafort. I'm guessing there will be. But, two, the way he spiked the football after the first indictments came out, see, there's no collusion, and then it was like Mueller had that 1-2 punch. It's like a little bit of rope-a-dip. Okay, how about this? And
absolutely.
Then drops the guilty plea from George Papadopoulos. So you're out there, you see the president and his supporters out there with their whole spin that there's nothing about collusion, and then you drop the guilty plea from the cooperating witness who is going to talk directly to the question of collusion.
Let me ask you, Charlie. In your book, you have an excellent section on the second generation conservative media and how their presence kind of like in the 80s, the lack of media actually proved beneficial to Reagan because it allowed him more maneuvering room. This time, you've got a full throated conservative media out there hollering in Trump's favor. What have we seen? You're not going to see cracks in Republicans in Congress until you see cracks in the media. Are we seeing any at all yet?
Not so far. In fact, this is one of the, I think, most interesting parts about the political dynamic is that the president really does have kind of a state-controlled media to provide him with the air cover. And I've speculated, and of course we'll never know, but I've speculated that if Richard Nixon had enjoyed this kind of media cover during Watergate, he would have survived. I mean,
You
had Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and the Breitbarts every day saying that this was a witch hunt or some such thing. And I think that's one of the stories in the book, how the conservative movement has really outsourced its thought leadership to kind of the loudmouth at the end of the bar, by which I mean this new generation of media.
Yeah, but I think it's important to point out that lest anybody believe that your book is somehow a polemic attacking Trump supporters, you're much more thoughtful than that. And one of the points you make in the book is picking up on the notion of media. You say mainstream media is complicit in the dumbing down of the electorate. And you go on to say, the problem here is obvious. An ignorant electorate is not likely to hold ignorant politicians to account. If voters don't know what they don't know, they will also be unlikely to recognize or care very much about what politicians don't know. So ignorance begets ignorance and the tolerance of it in high places. And the mainstream media plays a role in all that, yes?
It does, and there have been some really extraordinary studies showing how little attention, for example, the major networks have paid to actual issues. It's all horse race, it's all personality, it's all gossip. I'd also throw in an indictment, perhaps, of our educational system, that we're now paying the price for not teaching civics, not teaching history, not enabling people to put things in context. Because, I say this as a conservative who we used to, you may have heard other conservative hosts, talk about the low information voters that supported Barack Obama, and then it turns around in 2016 that pretty much nobody was lower information than some of our own folks. So a lot of people complicit in that. By the way, you can tell that I'm not running for office, that I'm willing to say things like this.
you also actually, to keep on this theme just for another moment, you actually have a really terrific quote from Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who we just heard from. And I assume this is when she was she working for her dad when she said what we missed was that nobody cared about solutions? Is that where she was at that point?
I think she was in between gigs at that point.
Yeah,
she was heading.
Go ahead.
Well, and she basically said, that we realized that nobody was interested in solutions. Nobody was interested in actual ideas. And that's one of the things that's happened in American politics, that, the three of us, we may be under the impression that politics is about ideas, it's about programs, it's about accomplishments, when really politics is increasingly about attitude. It's about tribal loyalty. And I think that is seen. We see that play out again and again and again.
Yeah, she says they just wanted to burn it all down. They didn't care about building it back up. They wanted to burn it to the ground and figure out what to do with the ashes afterward. That's a more articulate Sarah Huckabee Sanders, Jim, than we're hearing from these days in the briefing room.
Yeah. Hey, Charlie, here's we had not too long ago, maybe a couple of weeks ago, we had Jeff Flake on. He too was plugging a book, but he was still in re-election mode then, and I asked him, I said, if you fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. When do we start blaming the voters for what they're doing, for just their lack of curiosity here?
Well, or their lack of standards. And I start my book out by saying this is not a book about Donald Trump. You know, it's about a Republican Party that embraced him, they capitulated to him, and now is enabling him. And I do worry about what is happening to the electorate, what's happening to our political culture, not just what they know and what they don't know, but their tolerance for, I don't know, put this bluntly, being lied to. Their tolerance for certain things that would have been disqualifying just a few years ago. And I think that's one of the things that we ought to be concerned about, this erosion of these democratic and cultural norms, because you wonder where we're going to be, even after Donald Trump leaves the stage. Have we so damaged our civil culture in terms of the way we talk to one another, what we're willing to tolerate, what we're willing to rationalize? Are we going to snap back quickly? I'm not that optimistic.
Jim was very complimentary about your book, which I think he's right about. As a fellow radio talk show host, though, Charlie, I'm disappointed he doesn't think we're capable of putting a written sentence together.
No. Bill, this man was a writer before he was a talk show host.
I know that. But Charlie, one of the things you do in the book is you give us a pretty good fairly recent history of the conservative movement. And you bemoan the loss of the conservative thinking class, the Bill Buckleys of the world. And you take us back to 1964 and talk about the response after Barry Goldwater was annihilated, that was your word, by LBJ. And the consensus was that the GOP, you say, would have to shake off the stink of the right and move to the center. So what happened from that point on? You describe it in your book, but move us forward, because the party made efforts at that. But when Gerald Ford made Nelson Rockefeller his running mate, that provoked a conservative backlash that put the party right back to the right again, yes?
Yeah, it did. And several things happened in the mid-1960s, and they involved William F. Buckley, Jr. Number one, he expelled or excommunicated the John Birch Society from the conservative movement. He basically said, look, we have to clean our own house. We have to get rid of the bigots. We have to get rid of the crackpots. And that was an important, crucial step. There is no one who can do that now. It would have been nice if you'd had a Bill Buckley that could have done that with the alt-right today. But also what he did was, Bill Buckley actually ran for mayor of New York City in 1965 as a conservative on that ticket, not because he thought he'd win, but because he said, okay, let's start laying out what we believe in, what our solutions are, what our vision of society is. And it is a remarkable historic notation that 16 years after Republicans were annihilated in 64, they elected Ronald Reagan in 1980. But that was a process again, led by thought leaders who I think took these principles seriously. So we've gone from Bill Buckley to what? Ann Coulter. We've gone from Edmund Burke to Sean Hannity. It has not been an upgrade.
Or Sarah Palin.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, the splody heads.
I'll tell you, Charlie, can you stay with us for a few more minutes? We got to get a break in. Will you stay with us?
Sure, I will.
Thank you very much. So let's take a brief break and come back with Charlie Sykes and Jim Galloway. Charlie Sykes' book is How the Right Lost Its Mind. We'll be right back.
Hey, this is David Green, host of Morning Edition. I'm here to talk with you about that poking feeling, the one that keeps reminding you to support public radio. You can support the programs you love by donating your used vehicle. That old car or truck could be worth hundreds of dollars to this station. All you have to do is call, and you might even receive a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR, and thanks.
Back on Political Rewind, Jim Galloway, AJC lead political reporter. You read him in the Dead Tree edition of the paper on Wednesdays and Sundays, and he oversees the Politically Georgia website of the AJC, behind a paywall now, Galloway. $3.99 a month?
Dime a day. That's all I'm worth. Dime a day.
Worth it. And Charlie Sykes is in Milwaukee. The great conservative talk show host, a mainstay in the Midwest for more than 23 years, Charlie, on the air?
23 years, yeah.
So you were an early opponent of President Trump. You spoke out loudly and clearly in a part of the country where there were a lot of people who thought Donald Trump was the answer to our country's ills. And you kept that up all the way through the campaign. But you tell us that your decision to step down really wasn't a response to Trump. There were other factors involved. And I'm not asking you. You said they were personal, and that may mean they're off limits. But you did not leave that show because of Trump, right?
No, actually, because I turned 63 this year. I'd always circled this in my calendar. Like, if I was going to make a change, that would be it. But I have to tell you that Donald Trump and what happened to the conservative movement and the Republican Party certainly made that decision much, much easier.
Hey, let me ask you. Okay, I'm assuming that because you're still in Milwaukee, you keep in touch with your political circle there. I mean, Wisconsin gave us Reince Priebus, it gave us Paul Ryan, and I'm assuming you keep in touch with them. How are they doing this balancing act?
Well, I keep in touch with them, I would say more sporadically. Look, I think a lot of Republicans have made this bargain, and I've described Paul Ryan's bargain as a Faustian bargain. I know that sounds harsh, but essentially making, you know, his argument is that, look, if I want to get the policies that I have worked for my whole life signed into law, I have to work with this guy. So I'm going to make these sacrifices. I'm going to look the other way. I'm going to keep my mouth shut because I really, really want to get tax cuts. And I guess that's why I asked, you know, the question, you know, from A Man for All Seasons, you know, what profits it a man to, you know, to gain the whole world if he loses his soul, but to do it for whales, but to do it for tax cuts.
It's
the trade-off, the price tag for the trade-off rises all the time.
You know, one of the moments in which I was particularly struck by this, and I wonder if you were Charlie or you were Jim. You know, Trump has been going after Bob Corker for a while now, and then he really unloaded, maybe in even more offensive ways, on Jeff Flake when Flake said he was not going to run for re-election. And no one on the Hill, none of the leadership, was willing to stand up for. Mitch McConnell swept aside questions about it. I don't think Ryan made any particularly strong pronouncements about it. And that struck me as really troubling if you're a member of Congress and want the people who you work with, who want your vote, if they don't think that the leaders have your back. Is there something to that?
And Charlie, tell me if I'm missing something, but I would flip that scenario. I would say that Flake and Corker know that there is something that everybody else is thinking, but everybody else cannot say it, and so they cannot come to their rescue as well.
I think that's correct, I think that's what's really extraordinary about both of those speeches was, you know, how bracing and how blunt they were, and how all of the folks on Capitol Hill, you know, seem to understand that a lot of people say that in private, but they're not willing to say it in public. And the reason they're not willing to say it in public is because the base has not moved, because the conservative media has not moved. And therefore, they do recognize that it would be an act of political suicide right now to take on Donald Trump if you're worried about a Republican primary. But that really does tell you the state of the Republican Party. And it was really on display last week. You had these eloquent speeches. You had McCain give a speech. You had George W. Bush's speech about what's happening to our politics. Corker's comments, Flake's comments. And yet, the general reaction of the Republican Party in Washington was pretty much complete surrender and capitulation.
And that's my point, I think, that I get what you and Jim are saying, that, in fact, the two men who've decided not to run for re-election have the freedom to speak out. But we are increasingly seeing the fear that dominates the Republicans up there on the Hill. And I would argue, I mean, and so that's why I come back to what I started with, really, Charlie, is at what point do the Republicans in Congress start to think, as this investigation moves forward, and as you said, the 1-2 punch, which really was powerful, to have both something directly involved with Russia and then the Manafort indictment. I mean, at a certain point, they've got to be waking up in the middle of the night and wondering about the train that they've jumped on and how far it's going to get them before it wrecks.
Well, some of us have been trying to warn them about that for a year and a half, and they've managed to ignore those warnings rather consistently. But I do think that you're not going to see much movement until you see a drop in the polls of support among Republicans.
Sure.
And maybe there's going to have to be some switch in the economy or some such thing. But I think that their capacity to play whataboutism and rationalize is pretty extraordinary when it comes to this Russia investigation. However, once again, I think you got an indication of how aggressive this investigation is going to be and what the potential is for new information to come out. So I would, if I'm Paul Ryan, I just have to hope that I get my tax bill done as quickly as possible before it gets completely overshadowed by this.
A quick breaking news item. Our producer, Tom Faust, told us that both Manafort and Gates have now been in court, and they've both entered not guilty pleas, which isn't even vaguely surprising, Jim.
No. But to take Charlie up on his point, we've got a horse race now that has nothing to do with 2018. It's Robert Mueller versus this tax cut. And to see who's going to get further by December 31st, I think if it's Bob Mueller, then Republicans are in a deep well there.
Yeah, Charlie, how do they turn to tax reform or tax cuts, which is what it really is, I think, on Wednesday and Thursday and beginning of next week? They're going to be completely overshadowed by developing stories around the investigation. This must be very defeating if you're trying to get a tax bill passed.
Well, this has been the story of Paul Ryan's life for the last 2 years. Every time he's trying to get traction, Trump does something. Look, this is going to be there's two different ways of looking at the tax cut. Number one, it's incredibly complicated to reform the tax code. Well, that's always difficult. On the other hand, this puts more pressure on them. They absolutely have to pass something. They have to get a win, because if they don't get a tax cut done and this investigation keeps growing, then they really are in a world of hurt.
So
they really are. So I think among the Republicans, they're looking at each other and going, it doesn't really even matter what's in this bill. We just have to pass something.
Well,
we need to win.
I'm glad you've said that, because I've been making that point on the show for the last couple of weeks, that Republicans are so desperate that the one thing that's going to bring them together is fear for their fear of getting reelected. So
yes.
You believe that's true, that they will, despite a lot of fighting, a lot of problems with the size of the deficit they're creating, you believe they're going to get this done before the end of the year, most likely?
Well, no, I
oh, you don't?
They have to get it done.
Okay.
The pressure, because if they don't, the consequences will be so
right.
catastrophic.
So do you think they're going to make it work, is what I'm asking.
I think if they don't make it will make the failure of healthcare look like just a minor blip.
Yeah. We're going to have to let you go in a couple minutes.
Sure.
I just like to I have one last question. I'll give Jim a chance to also. As I read your book, I kept thinking, I can't wait to get to the last chapter or so when Charlie Sykes gives me hope for the future, and that the country will heal and we'll all get on the same page. But you don't really give us that hope, first about the future of the Republican Party to come to its senses, in your opinion, and certainly not for the country to come together again. Do you have hope that somehow this is a fever dream that we'll all get through, Republicans will realize what they've done, and the party will go back to what it was before Trump came along?
Well, there's a distinction between optimism and hope. Optimism is just sort of sitting back and assuming that the favor will break and that everything will be okay. I guess I'm not an optimist, but hope is something, it's a theological virtue that if we all do the right thing, if we keep fighting, if we keep going back to first principles, if we step back and think, oh my God, what is happening to this country, that perhaps we'll find a way to fight through it and learn how important things like the Constitution, limited government, and fact-based journalism, all of those things are to us, that maybe there's some way that that we will reinvigorate those virtues. So I am hopeful, but not necessarily optimistic.
Okay, we've got something to build on here, and that is, okay, you can lie everywhere else in Washington, but you don't lie in front of an FBI agent. Start there.
Absolutely.
Charlie Sykes, the book is How the Right Lost Its Mind. By the way, you're not giving up radio for good, are you, Charlie?
Well, I'm not going to do a daily radio show again, I don't think, but it's very likely that I'm going to be doing something with some of the folks in public radio.
That's what I was getting to. I thought that might be happening. I didn't want to say
don't
more.
Don't want to get
than,
ahead of myself.
Okay.
Here,
but, all right. Yeah. Well, we would love to have you on public radio, and we would love to air that show right here on our statewide NPR network, George Public Broadcasting. Thanks so much for joining us today, Charlie.
Thank you. It's been great.
Let's take another break, and when we come back, Jim Galloway and I will continue. We sort of didn't talk about some of the really interesting details that came out of the news today. We'll talk about that, and we got some good state and local stories to discuss, too. This is Political Rewind.
On the next Fresh Air, John Hodgman, contributor to The Daily Show and This American Life. He gets personal in his new collection of funny essays. In high school, he wore long hair, a fedora, and carried a briefcase.
That's the look I was going for in high school. Emotionally terrified weirdo who was tricking people into thinking he was interesting by wearing funny clothes.
Join us.
Tune in for the conversation today at 3 here on GPB.
That was a short break. We're back.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah,
you know, Charlie Sykes, one of the things I found most interesting in that book, Jim, was, we couldn't get into it in depth, I asked him a little bit about it, is the way in which he does track the history, the contemporary history of the conservative, the thought leaders of the Conservative Party and what happened to them in the decades.
He's got a wonderful chapter on Rush Limbaugh and why he wasn't at the forefront of the Trump movement. What is the stumble that happened 2 or 3 years before that?
Yeah, but then how quickly Limbaugh had to get into the fold, which was the point that Sykes made. But we do bemoan to some extent. He talks about in the 60s that we had great conservative thinkers. We talked about Bill Buckley Jr. and others. You had the Heritage Foundation, which back in the day was an organization that issued policy statements that were thoughtful and gave conservatives some meat to throw back at Democrats.
Now it has become another
arm of Trump.
Yeah, a bomb thrower.
Yeah, yeah. So the book is really a great read for people out there who are political junkies, and you wouldn't be listening to the show if you weren't. Jim, let's go back to a couple of things that we talked about in terms of the indictment. So, as we've already said, Manafort and Gates are indicted early this morning. We don't know much about Rick Gates except that he's Manafort's number one guy,
right,
and was there.
Manafort was his mentor. Yeah,
and he was part of the campaign. And interestingly enough, while Manafort was essentially fired from the campaign after it began to be revealed that he had been dealing, as we've now learned even more, with this indictment with leaders in the Ukraine, pro-Russian leadership in the Ukraine. Gates stayed on. And in fact, Gates played a role in the inauguration and in the transition. So Gates was there for more. And it'll be interesting to see how much information he might have going forward if pressure is applied to him, having had a seat at the table throughout all of that.
Right. I mean, the thing is that you've got Ms. Sanders in the White House saying that they had no role in the campaign, but Paul Manafort's expertise and connections to Russia and Ukraine were reasons that he became the campaign manager, the chairman of the campaign. It was that link to Putin that attracted Trump.
So we'll watch for that. And as we all said, there's probably more to come, especially with Manafort. And these indictments today don't preclude the feds, Mueller, from coming back and amending the indictment to add, obviously, other charges. The Papadopoulos link, which we've already talked about and which surprised everyone today, is really fascinating because it goes right to the heart of the matter. And here's a couple of the items that were in the government's documentation of Papadopoulos's role. Papadopoulos was in touch with the professor. Don't know his name. A professor in Russia who apparently had links, strong ties to the Russian government.
To the foreign ministry, yes. Mm-hmm.
This is directly from the government's documents on Papadopoulos. Papadopoulos emailed foreign contact number 2, presumably the professor, and proposed a meeting, quote, for August or September in the UK, London, with me and my national chairman and maybe one other foreign policy advisor and you, members of President Putin's office and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, to hold a day of consultations and to meet one another. It's been approved from our side. It's only what he says,
right?
But that's stunning. If it can be proven that the Trump campaign knew about this.
And then you throw that in the line of the June meeting that Donald Trump Jr. and I think Manafort and everybody else, the Jared Kushners of the world had in Trump Towers with the Russian contact.
We also have in the documentation, Papadopoulos on another occasion emailed the high-ranking campaign official with the subject line, new message from Russia. So here he is talking to the Trump campaign, somebody at a high level. The Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs messaged and said that if Mr. Trump is unable to make it to Russia, if a campaign rep, me or someone else, can make it for meetings, I am willing to make the trip off the record if it's in the interest of Mr. Trump and the campaign to meet specific people. Again, we don't know for a fact that the Trump campaign authorized any of this, and that's what Robert Mueller is clearly investigating.
Right, and the one thing I would point out, if I'm not mistaken, George Papadopoulos was arrested in July.
July. They've had him under wraps since
they've
July.
Had him under that's wraps right. since, and the formal guilty plea came October 5. Well, it kind of, I've got to believe that you cannot arrest a former foreign policy advisor without the President of the United States finding out somehow. And it helps explain a little bit of the emphasis on in Donald Trump's Twitter feed
over
the last couple of weeks.
Yeah. All right. I mean, it's a huge day in Washington in terms of all this. And it's got to put the White House under such enormous pressure. It can only imagine what's going on in the Oval Office this afternoon.
Yeah, but if you were around in 1974, maybe it does have a familiar ring.
Right. excuse me. We have another breaking news story, as if we don't have enough. A federal court in Washington, D.C., a federal judge, has ruled, has blocked President Trump's rule that to throw trans or to not accept transgender individuals into the armed forces. The judge has said that transgender recruitment or enlistment has to continue. Of course, the Trump administration is going to contest that. They'll appeal that, but it's another bad news day for part of the bad news day for Mr. Trump.
Right, and you wonder how it's how many people's careers are affected by this. I mean, it's not as if you're in this basket here, if you're a transgender person in the military, it's not as if you're going to get that next promotion at this point.
This is why I think when a Charlie Sykes says they've got to pass a tax bill, everything else seems to be, you know, Trump likes to point to the fact that, well, I've had these executive orders that have changed things. And in fact, there are things that we have allowed to fly under the radar. In EPA, especially, some of the environmental protections that the White House has stripped are particularly strong examples. We now learn that Betsy DeVos is coming up with some new regulations on student the Obama administration had said that the government was going to pay the tuition fees of students who were in schools, private universities that defrauded them. And we've now learned that Betsy DeVos thinks that the government has been overly generous, and just because you put $10,000 into a school that turned out to be fraudulent, that doesn't mean that the government should cover all your expenses. So there are things going on that we don't spend much time talking about.
You know, there are two sides to a non-majoritarian democracy, which is what we have now. You know, we had Republicans complaining about the executive orders that the Obama administration issued, and now it's Democrats' turns to argue that Trump is doing the exact same thing.
Yeah. You want to talk about some things going on in state politics?
Yeah.
Elena Parent, Democrat from Decatur area, DeKalb County out that way. She wants to introduce a bill, we learned, that will help cities, municipalities across the state deal with Confederate memorials. What's been the stumbling block, and what is she proposing?
Well, first of all, I would also, I believe she's got a partner in Mary Margaret Oliver.
Yes, that's right. Thank you.
A Democrat from Decatur. And those are two Democratic sponsors, which means the first thing that's going to happen is that there's going to be a Republican copy made if that's the vehicle that will proceed.
Right.
But you do have a situation that's made it on the radar, just courtesy of the Charlottesville and the debate over Confederate symbolism once again, that back in 2001 when Roy Barnes pushed through took down the 1956 flag with its battle emblem on it, the bargain struck was that the rest of the Confederate symbolism in Georgia would be protected, and it would be placed under the auspices of the protective auspices of the legislature. Okay, but that means that you have local monuments like the one in downtown Decatur, which is not owned by the state. It's owned by the municipality, and they are not permitted to do with that little piece of property what they want.
And so Elena Parent and Mary Margaret Oliver have introduced this legislation to say, give it back to the local authorities to do what they need to do.
And I'll tell you, this is the one part in the Confederate symbolism debate that I've heard some Republicans say, yes, this needs to be fixed, that local governments need to have say-so over what's in their community.
Yeah, I would think that, I would think if nothing else, if I'm a Republican in the state legislature, I don't want to continue to be forced to. I wouldn't want to be voting. I'd rather say you take care of it. Let me off the hook.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, who wants to vote on a bill that says the city of Decatur must clean the lichen off its statues every 6 months?
So, excuse me. With that in mind, the Confederate memorials have become an issue in the Virginia Senate race, which is being closely watched all over the country by political insiders, because you have the Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam, a Democrat, facing off against Ed Gillespie, who has been getting support from, they've each been getting support from their party leaders. And we've got a new poll which shows Northam up by as much as 17 points. That's a Quinnipiac poll, and they're good pollsters.
Yeah, and the thing is, Gillespie has tried to use the symbolism issue.
Yes,
you know, he has said in his TV commercials that I'm the guy who will keep the statues where they are. Northam has said that he would rather see them in a museum.
Yep.
But he would let local communities have their say. And the reason that's important here, Bill, is because, of course, we've got a gubernatorial race of our own next year. And how that issue affects the Virginia race could go a long way to saying to what we see in Georgia next year.
Yeah,
you've got Brian Kemp, who is making a very big play for rural voters who care about Confederate symbology. So is Michael Williams, the state senator from Cumming.
So But this race is fascinating. We remember, of course, that Hillary Clinton won Virginia. Mm-hmm. But there are openings for Republicans in Virginia. There are parts of the state that are very solidly red. So it isn't. It's not in the safe blue column by any means.
No, but what's fascinating is this is also a state that has elected one of the very, very few African-American governors,
yeah.
Doug Wilder, yeah. So many years back.
Yeah.
And now they're having an argument about Robert E. Lee.
Yeah. So that's one of the races that next week we'll be taking a deeper look at as we approach Election Day on November 7th, a week from tomorrow. Here in Atlanta, of course, we'll be spending a lot of time looking at the mayor's race, but we'll certainly watch that race. Of course, in Alabama, you've got Democrat Doug Jones against Republican Roy Moore, but that election doesn't take place until
December 12th.
December 12th,
right.
So that won't be on our radar next week. But there, too, the polls suggest that this is a tighter race than anybody'd ever anticipated. And Alabama sure is a solidly red state for the most part.
And I'll tell you, Bill, I mean, we were talking about the tax cut and the must-pass stuff and how Republicans will know if and when it's time to stand up to Donald Trump. A couple signals. We've got one signal that could be sent in November with the Virginia governor's race and another one in December.
I was a little surprised. We're used to hearing politicians, elected officials, be a little bit equivocal in whether they'll say yes or no on a given issue. I was a little surprised that Charlie Sykes wasn't ready to put his money down on the fact Republicans have to pass this tax bill, period, and they're going to because the pressure is so great.
Well, I mean, how many times have all of us made these predictions about what's going to come next in Washington?
I haven't made one wrong yet, have you?
I haven't broken my losing streak is what I haven't done.
So the White House has now said that Jimmy Carter, Trump loves him. Trump has now tweeted about, you know, Jimmy Carter knows what I'm going through with the fake news media, but Carter's not going to go to North Korea to negotiate, it appears.
It's not a surprise.
No.
But man, wouldn't it have been the piece de resistance for a 93-year-old former president to go back to Asia and cut that deal?
It would have been. I mean, those of us, like you've covered Jimmy Carter for many years, so have I. And yes, I mean, just as a personal, on a personal note, it would have been great to have seen him get to do that.
And I think he knows more about North Korea than Donald Trump does. So.
Another story, just go through a few fairly quickly. 12 of our members of Congress, two Democrats, the rest Republicans, have now signed a letter sent to the Ways and Means Committee in the House saying, please, please extend this deadline, which I can't remember what the date was initially.
2020.
Right. That it's a deadline that gives, in this case, an $800 billion tax credit to Georgia Power, to Southern Company, to continue to use for further construction on Plant Vogtle. It was supposed to applied only to those facilities that are finished by 2020. The issue now is that's not going to be built by 2020.
And it fits. It's part of the must-have financial formula if Georgia Power is going to be able to continue to build these two reactors. The final decision comes up before the PSC in February.
Yeah.
So it makes sense to try to put it in this tax package and get it out of the way in December. I think the last time I talked to Johnny Isaacson about this, he said that he had his eyes on December 31st.
Yeah. And of course, I think it certainly was in the Politically Georgia blog. I don't know if it was you who had the byline. This will apply only to Georgia and Plant Vogtle, since we're the only.
No. It applies to any power company that has nuclear reactors that are being constructed.
Yeah.
It just happens that Georgia Power is the only one.
That's going to be a story as the year turns. That in addition to the legislature, watching what happens in the PSC on Plant Vogtle is going to be fascinating. Renee Unterman, a solid, sound Republican from Gwinnett County in the state Senate. She's now suggesting, one of a number of Republicans who are beginning to crack open the door on the state accepting federal money to expand Medicaid. In her case, Jim, she says that we need it to because we don't have enough treatment centers for opioid and heroin abusers.
Right, right. And the other part of that is the Senate, well, the Congress in general hasn't been able to repeal Obamacare. But if it ever gets to that point, you saw that the House version, the version that the House passed out this last summer, actually punished the states that didn't expand Medicaid. Yeah. It gave them less money in the future. And so that might be another reason that you'd want to go on and expand it.
Do you imagine, as you talk to legislators, does it look to you like they really, and the governor, of course, is key to this, does it appear that they might really do this, or is it just talk at this point?
Right now, given that it's an election year, and we've got, you know, I would say it's just talk. But after November of next year, it might not be if we're still in this hole.
All right, Jim Galloway. It's always I kind of like these opportunities I have to just talk to you. Because you've got a lot, you know a lot, Jim.
It's like a radio quiz show.
Yeah. Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the AJC. So we have an interesting week for you. We'll be back on Wednesday, of course, at 2 o'clock with another Political Rewind. And we hope that by 2 o'clock on Wednesday, we will have seen this Republican tax bill, which has been held secret for so long. They've been working on it very quietly. Maybe Jim is giving me this look like don't count on it, but they claim that it'll be available on Wednesday. If it is, we'll certainly talk about it then. And then on Thursday, we really have an interesting two-way street for you. With Daylight Savings Time ending on Sunday, we decided to look at something that I don't know about you, I'd never thought of before. Whoever decided what time is what? Whoever said there ought to be some kind of standardization of time? And in fact, it turns out that as recently as the late 19th century in America, different towns and within a town, different stores were keeping different times. And there was no such thing as real standardized time. And we're going to tell the story of time and how it was measured here in the United States in a really interesting conversation. I hope you think it is on Thursday's Two-Way Street at 2 o'clock. So that's it for us for today. My thanks to associate producer Olivia Rheingold, producer Tom Faust, and engineer Tyler Morris, who's got the best. We should take a picture of Tyler because he has the best shaved head in this building. That's it for us today. Thanks for listening to us. We'll be back on Wednesday at 2 o'clock with another Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Have a great evening.